Once I had a sheltered upbringing. At my African school, we followed the O-level history syllabus, from which I learnt, amongst other things, that George Villiers, later Duke of Buckingham, was King James I's favourite. They never said in what sense. They never, for instance, showed me the correspondence. Here's Buckingham, aged 32, writing to his 58-year-old royal friend.
Dear Dad and Gossip, your last command was I should write merrily and short. How may you expect the performance of this from me, having filled my heart so full of thoughts for my reception yesterday? When I came, my entertainment being there, and my leave-taking was such, nay, I say such, sir, that all the way hither I entertained myself, your unworthy servant, with this dispute. Whether you loved me now, my ever dear master, here, give me leave to say, a full heart must either vent itself or break, and that oftentimes the senses are better expressed in absence and by letter than otherwise. You know full thoughts cause long parentheses. Whether you loved me now better than at the time which I shall never forget at Farnham, where the bed's head could not be found between the master and his dog. Sir, if you mark not well the parenthesis, it does break the sense. That was my desire, and if therein I did deceive, it was with my good will. To conclude, these thoughts are never likely to break your faithful servant's heart, which, whensoever it shall be truly and thoroughly searched, shall be found full of love, faith, and obedience to you. In one thing excepted, that I will not be so hastily rich as you would make me, though covetously I will make myself so in this eternally to deserve your blessing. P.S. I pray you, sir, tell your sweet baby Charles that I will write of you both before many hours pass, and by the grace of God, be at the death of a stag with you.
Dear Dad and Gossip seems a funny way to begin a letter to a king. I asked Roger Lockyer what Dad and Gossip was all about.
The point was, Buckingham was, of course, the king's favourite, so he could take liberties that other people couldn't. Then he'd lost his father when he was quite young, and there is a sense in which he was always searching for a substitute. Gossip, of course, is the 17th century word for godfather, and the king really was Buckingham's dad, surrogate dad, and his godfather, the person who guided him religiously and in every other way. Dad's a very affectionate term. And oddly enough, there's not a lot of evidence that it was used between sons and fathers, but it was occasionally, but it's much more a term of intimacy.
What were the circumstances of their meeting?
We don't know for certain where they met, but probably at the great house which still survives in Northamptonshire called Apethorpe. It was a chance meeting, but it was immediately followed up because the reigning favourite, the Earl of Somerset, was associated with James's desire to marry his son, Prince Charles, to a Spanish princess. And what we call the Protestant interest, the hardline Protestants in England, were appalled at this. And they decided, they took the terrible risk, really, of trying to push another young man in James's way in the hopes that James would take to him, and that they could then use this young man to advanced Protestant.
Now, this is rather extraordinary what you're suggesting, that the Protestants, knowing that the king had a physical predilection for young men, put a young man in his way, so to speak, in the hope of securing control over him.
Yes, it's what you might call a realist policy. It's even more remarkable when you consider that the two principal people involved were the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Lord Chamberlain, the Earl of Pembroke. And they go to the most extraordinary lengths. They washed Buckingham's face in sort of acid's milk in order to give it a good complexion, a sort of early version of fabulous pink camé. They equip him in the latest sort of fashionable clothes. And then they actually resort, almost physically, to sort of pushing him in front of the king. But fortunately, I mean, it succeeded. At least it succeeded in the short run. In fact, it made no difference to James's policy at all. But they took the risk, and it worked. So by 1615, Buckingham is really quite securely the reigning favourite.
Wasn't there a certain amount of disapproval of that kind of behaviour, though, even in a king, and wasn't it thought odd to trade on it?
Yes. It's always very difficult to know what people thought of the king's proclivities. After all, they probably weren't widely known outside a fairly small circle. Though having said that, it is the case that there are an enormous number of anonymous doggerel poems, couched in fairly obscene language, aimed at this particular proclivity of James. And on the other hand, a king is a king is a king, and kings could do what other people couldn't do, and he was, after all, ruler. And as the Archbishop and the Lord Chamberlain recognised, if you want to get something done, it's better to come to terms with the ruler than to try and work against his inclinations.
Was Buckingham a young man on the make, or did he love James?
That's not an easy question to answer. Was he a young man on the make? Certainly. He was the second son of a second marriage. He wasn't rich, and he wanted to get ahead. Before he met the king in 1614, he was seen at a race course, I think in Newmarket, with his jacket out at elbow and looking pretty much as though he didn't have a penny to rub together. And yet, in 1614, he meets the king, and by 1618, he's gone through all ranks of the aristocracy up to marquis, and by 1623, when he ascended the final rung, he became the first non-royal duke in England for about a century, and by that time he was one of the richest men in the whole kingdom. Did he love James? Yes, I think he did. It depends, of course, what you mean by love. They both loved hunting, they both loved the open-air life, they both loved gardens and great houses and so on. James made it possible for Buckingham to have the sort of life that would otherwise have been quite inconceivable. So I think he was a young man on the make, but who found in the king somebody for whom he had a genuine respect and towards whom he had a genuine, shall we say, emotional commitment.
Did Buckingham have girlfriends too?
Oh, yes. He certainly had a number of girlfriends. And then quite early on, in 1620, he married Catherine Manners, the daughter of the Earl of Rutland. And that was a stormy, tempestuous, but obviously, in a sense, very successful marriage. She really adored him. And every indication that he was very fond of her and very fond indeed of their children. And I should say that James's generosity extended not simply to Buckingham, but to Buckingham's wife, Buckingham's mother, Buckingham's children, Buckingham's brothers and half-brothers. The whole kindred, as it was called, were showered with titles and favour as a consequence.
So there's no evidence that either of them resented the spouses of the other party, the wives of the other party?
No, none at all. Really, Buckingham's family became, one has to say, members of the royal family. And it's not surprising that if you walk around Westminster Abbey, the royal tombs, you find that they're all royal with one exception, and that is Buckingham. Buckingham and his children are there, and that's because they were, in effect, subsumed into the royal family.
But there was a hiccup. An argument arose about James's pro-Spanish policy, which Buckingham came to doubt.
I think that it's very likely indeed that Buckingham would have fallen from favour, fallen from power, had it not been for the fact that he was always subject to what we would call nervous prostration at moments of great stress. And this very great stress brought on one of these periods of nervous prostration which resulted in physical illness, jaundice. And it was thought that he was going to die. And the king was absolutely overcome with remorse at what he'd done and with horror at the thought that he was going to lose his favourite. And it brought his sort of love for Buckingham, it came flooding back. He went to Buckingham's bedside and uttered a most astonishing prayer that God would take his life, the king's, and preserve his favourites. Well, in fact, Buckingham recovered, but from then on there was no question of his ever being out of favour. The love between the two was stronger than it had ever been.
James was plainly in love with Buckingham.
Oh, yes, indeed.
And can you tell from this letter, or is this the kind of letter that people used to write all the time?
No, it's a most unusual letter. The background, of course, to it is Buckingham's illness, his temporary fall from favour, and his recovery both from illness and to favour. And so he goes to see the king at court. And obviously he's given such a warm welcome, such a warm reception, that as he goes back, he's just thinking it over all the time. And he says that my entertainment being there at court and my leave-taking was such that I asked myself whether you love me now better than at the time, which I shall never forget, at Farnham, where the bed's head could not be found between the master and his dog. Now, that refers to an episode in 1615 when the king was on progress through Hampshire, and at Farnham Castle, where the young George Villiers was in attendance, obviously something happened. Where the bed's head could not be found between the master and his dog obviously means that they were in bed together. I don't think one should assume more than that.
Shouldn't one?
Well, it wasn't uncommon for people to share beds in the 17th century. It was a sign of friendship.
But to write about it afterwards, to refer lovingly to it in a,
well,
in a note.
It would be it would mark a moment of intimacy. It might not imply more than at the present day inviting your girlfriend out to dinner or something like that. In other words, we shouldn't necessarily assume.
What do you think actually happened?
Well, Bucking was a very good-looking and highly sexed young man, so I'd be very surprised if some sort of sexual relationship didn't take place. But one will never know.
Buckingham refers in the postscript to your sweet baby Charles. Who is he talking about?
Baby Charles is the heir to the throne.
But he's not a baby anymore,
is he? No, Charles was as old as the century, so in 1624 he was 24 years old. And I think it does tell one something about James's attitude towards his second son. The eldest son, Prince Henry, had tragically died. And Charles was clearly, as far as his father was concerned, still this undeveloped baby. And so when he says, sweet baby Charles, he's saying, in effect, my greetings to my very close friend, and my greetings also to your baby. It's another sign, I think, of the fact that Buckingham was, to all intents and purposes, a member of the royal family.
Would James have replied to letters like this?
Yes, James wouldn't have replied, I think, to this particular letter, since this was, as it were, a bread and butter, a thank you letter.
Yes.
But there was a constant correspondence between the two, of course, only when they were away from each other. But interestingly enough, there is a letter a little later than this particular one from James to Buckingham, and it gives one, as it were, James's view of the relationship. And it's James writing to Buckingham, telling him how much he was looking forward to a visit from him, and hoping, in James's own words, that we may make at this Christmas a new marriage ever to be kept hereafter. For God so loved me, as I desire only to live in this world for your sake, and that I had rather live banished in any part of the earth with you than live a sorrowful widow's life without you. And so God bless you, my sweet child and wife, and grant that ye may ever be a comfort to your dear dad and husband. That must, I think, be the most extraordinary letter ever written by an English king.
And the most extraordinary letter ever made public from an English king,
the most
anyway.
Extraordinary letter ever made public. And what I think it shows is that this odd relationship was, if you like, an obsession, but for all its oddity, was a genuine love relationship,
yes.
And a genuine love relationship on both sides.
Roger Lockyer clearly takes the relationship seriously. But wasn't this, I asked Jenny Wormald, just a grand flirtation?
James was a very serious person. He clearly liked male company. He did have male friends who were simply entertaining, perhaps pretty boys, but the great favourites, of whom Buckingham was the fourth and last, were themselves serious people involved in politics and would not have got into the position they did had they not been.
Was this a homosexual relationship, do you think? And if so, was it from the start?
Yes, it probably was. It was certainly seen as such. And the letter which Buckingham wrote makes it pretty clear that the relationship did have a physical aspect. Whether one needs to get very worked up about it is another matter.
If Buckingham cared little for James, was simply using him, do you think James would have noticed?
Oh, yes. The striking thing, I think, about Buckingham is the extent to which he pleased the king. I think he soothed James, and had James felt that this was all simply show, rather than out of a genuine affection, as well, of course, as self-interest, then the relationship would have ended much sooner.
Given James's almost infatuation with Buckingham, would it have been easy for Buckingham to have translated that emotional relationship into a position of power and influence, or will James have been suspicious and resistant of that?
No, I think James was very happy to allow Buckingham to act on his behalf, but the crucial thing is on his behalf. I mean, I think one would never really argue, if one was talking about a royal mistress, the more normal situation, that the passion of a king meant that the royal mistress could do what she liked. And I've never understood why it's supposed to be different in the bedchamber of a king with his homosexual favourite. I mean, one can imagine the sort of conversation. Darling, you say you love me and you won't do a little thing like whatever I want. Why should Buckingham be more successful at that kind of line than a mistress?
How did James's other friends take to Buckingham? Were they jealous?
No, very much not. This is a casual, friendly man who loves someone. Again, let me draw the parallel. Wives or mistresses don't exclude other friends. Neither does a male favourite.
Despite Jenny Wormald's opinion, there is a temptation to take the giggling, cuckoo tone of this letter as evidence that James's and Buckingham's affair was a shallow one. And yet think of the silly notelets that you or I might have written to people for whom our love was in fact quite serious. Things like this letter, that were meant to be private, far from being a secret window into the whole truth, need very great care in their interpretation.